You're listening to the best of Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, for a while, it seemed like the saga of the US presidential election would never end, but end it did. Joe Biden won the presidency in November with 306 electoral college votes to Donald Trump's 232. But who exactly is Joe Biden? Well, Evan Osnos has written the Joe Biden story in his book called Joe Biden, American Dreamer. Now, Evan knows Joe Biden very well, so I asked him whether he sees clues in Joe Biden as to the kind of leader that he might become.
Yeah, I think in some ways, you know, to be perfectly blunt about it, Biden could not be more different than Donald J. Trump if he tried. It's just embedded in his whole mindset is a very different approach to how to govern. I mean, he fundamentally believes a set of completely different ideas, beginning with the fact that he thinks that even in this moment of total polarization in this country, that it's not impossible to pull people together. I think that's a bit of aspiration more than kind of description of the facts on the ground. But that's his orientation, is to believe that if we actually can sit down and put aside some of these things like ego and put aside some of our usual political attachments, that, you know, we can begin to get out of this paralysis that we're in right now.
And do you think that in many ways that throughout his career he's followed his gut, if you like, and he has adapted to circumstances?
He really has. I mean, that's what comes through most clearly to me from my time of reporting his biography and talking to him and the people around him, is this kind of fascinating passage in which things would happen to him that he would never have asked for, never have anticipated, of course, never wanted. Some terrible tragedies, for one thing, as we know, the death of his late wife and his daughter, and then later the death of his son from a brain tumor. But the cumulative effect of those have been a kind of, I think you have to call it a humbling. I mean, it has forced him to reckon with the ways in which none of us are truly the authors of our own experience entirely, and we're bound by what fortune throws at us. And that is obviously something of meaning when it comes to crafting policies to try to reflect people's lives.
Okay, well then let's take a look at him, like, just as the person. I mean, he was always involved in politics from a very young age. He was actually elected a junior class president at his private day school in Delaware. That's sort of a good portent for the future, isn't it?
Well, it's what's interesting about it was he had this terrible stutter as a boy, and he broke the back of it by learning to recite speeches in the mirror at his house. But it was a real humiliation for him. I mean, he told me about remembering that kids would call him Joe Impedimenta in Latin class because he had an impediment. And when he was able to finally beat that, you know, partly by, you know, learning Irish poetry and things like that, it was, I think, a kind of slingshot effect that gave him this extraordinary, almost audacious sense of confidence to go out and imagine becoming a political person. And that was the beginning of this process. And indeed, he was class president, then he was class president again, and he went off to college. He wasn't much of a brilliant student, is the honest answer. He would say it himself. In fact, he wrote at one point in his own memoir, writing in the third person, he said, Joe Biden wasn't hitting the library every Saturday night. But in a way, what he did have was this extraordinary power to connect with people in a very authentic and sort of unadorned way. And that ended up carrying him through his life.
Okay, but of the things that you mentioned there, one is the stutter. And I get the impression his young years really were quite dominated by the fight to overcome the stutter. And he always returns to respect and vulnerability and these kind of things. And remembering, even now as he comes towards 80 years of age, if I was to ask Joe Biden, do you remember the names of the people who bullied you at school? He would remember those names. So on that note, has he never entirely shed his insecurity? And that's not necessarily a bad thing for a leader.
That's exactly right. I find actually he has this, what I would describe as a kind of productive insecurity, that it leads him to be open constantly to the recognition that he may not know everything and that there may be something that you know that he doesn't know and that he wants to find out what it is. And I have found that in my encounters with him, my conversations over the years, that he's like a vacuum cleaner, sort of hoovering up information that he doesn't know. And that's not something you always encounter in people in their eighth decade. You know, he has this combination of being, I think, pretty confident in his political instincts. They've carried him to where he is, but he's not sealed off from the introduction of the recognition that he may have been wrong about things. He has said to me, I mean, the thing that is most striking in our conversations is how often he's said to me, look, I made a choice in, you know, some issue 15, 20 years ago, and that was wrong. It was a mistake, and I realize now I didn't know enough to get it right.
Okay, you mentioned his first wife there. He met his first wife during a break in the Bahamas, and the stories about that, which are they're like kind of interesting, just about just exactly what happened. But he won his first seat, Senate seat, at the age of 29, and that was in 1972. And almost immediately, we're talking almost hours, complete catastrophe and tragedy struck. Just tell me about that.
Yeah, it is one of those stories that is almost too hard to get your mind around. He won this extraordinary upset in the Senate, one of the closest and most unexpected wins in the history of the Senate. And then just a few days later, he's at his office in Washington getting things set up. And the phone rings, and it's his brother calling. And his brother was reporting the news to him that his wife had been taking the three kids to go buy a Christmas tree, and they collided with a tractor trailer. And his late wife, Nelia Hunter, was killed. His daughter, Naomi, died at the scene. His two boys, Beau and Hunter, who were 2 and 3 at the time, were hospitalized with serious injuries. And you know, just to help you imagine the scene, I mean, there was the road was littered with the campaign pamphlets from this race. That's how kind of joined these two moments were in his life. And frankly, he thought of suicide. Never imagined that he would go into the Senate at this point. And he got some advice. He talked to an older member of Congress who had had a terrible experience in his own life, had lost his wife and a child. And that guy said to him, listen, you have only one way to pull through this, to survive, which is to throw yourself into your work. Because if you don't work and just work furiously, you'll cave in. And so that's what he did. He kind of became he went into the Senate, but every night he would go home on the train because he was a single father now. And so that fed this reputation of him as Amtrak Joe.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, it wasn't so much this kind of, you know, we sometimes look at it now as an affectation of a popular, you know, sort of being a man of the people. Actually, it originated for this brutal fact that there was nobody else to take care of his boys.
Right, indeed. And he was sworn in at the hospital bedside. And in 1988, he made his first run for president. He made a speech about his roots. Why would he bother stealing a speech, or did he, from Neil Kinnock?
Yeah, it's one of these odd moments that I think probably tells you a little bit about the pressures of running for president and the sheer kind of weary effect it has. Look, he had been quoting this Neil Kinnock speech all summer as he gave speeches. You can go back and you can hear him saying, you know, as Neil Kinnock said, and then he would tell a story about he would tell the story of coal mining ancestors and so on. And then one day in Iowa, he just dropped Kinnock and sort of braided the story into his own, just used it in the first person. And that was, of course, not true. He plagiarized the speech. And reporters took that and combined it with a couple of other facts, like he had also taken language from Bobby Kennedy and used it in a speech of his own. And so the overall effect was that it became sort of impossible for him to keep running. And, you know, years later, he was asked, what happened? For a while, he sort of tried to say it was the reporters making a bigger deal of it than they should. And then years later, he was asked in an interview, after he was sort of more comfortable acknowledging the reality of it. And he said, look, the honest answer is I was too arrogant.
Yeah,
I wasn't
yeah.
ready to be president.
And also his academic achievements, maybe a little bit more than they really were, or his civil rights work, maybe a little bit exaggerated also. And then even in 07, he described Barack Obama in less than glowing terms. And what happens then just around the corner? Obama picked him. Who was surprised? Yeah. Like, first of all, was Biden surprised, and was everybody else surprised?
He was, actually. He was. I mean, Biden initially, when he was asked to become vice president, people thought, what an odd countercultural choice, because after all, Barack Obama is this history-making president. He's a sort of face of diversity, and here he goes and he chooses good old white Midwestern Joe Biden. It just seems like an odd choice. And what the truth was, the political calculation was part of it, which is that Biden did connect to a part of the country that Obama was having trouble connecting with. But the other fact is, Obama really respected Biden's expertise on foreign relations, on the byways of Washington, on dealing with Congress. I've spoken to President Obama about that moment, about that choice. And what he says was, I recognize that there were things that Joe could do, in effect, that was hard for me to do.
Yeah.
So they ended up being quite a powerful duo, and I think, even though neither one expected it.
Yeah, and Obama realized that Biden had a lot of virtues. He had, as you say, contacts on Capitol Hill, very, very vital also, and very substantial political talents as well, an awful lot of experience. Just getting to Trump and Biden, I mean, Trump is a crowd pleaser, well, to his own crowd anyway, and Biden is better at close contact, is he? Better with personal empathy?
He is, yeah, fundamentally. I mean, if you spend time with him, you see this recurring scene, which is quite striking, which is that wherever he goes, people seek him out and they stop him. I mean, they grab him by the arm. I've seen this over and over. And they say to him, I have suffered a terrible thing in my life. I lost my spouse or I lost a child and I don't know what to do and I don't know how to get through. I mean, he's become a kind of symbol of endurance and resilience. And you know what's interesting about it, it's never a job he wanted, actually. Of course, you know, it was thrust upon him by tragedy, and he ended up really embracing it and understanding that people needed him for that. That's what they were seeking from him. And and I've had a number of encounters over the years with people who I had no idea had any connection to him, who would tell me, oh yeah, you know, I got a call from Joe Biden after my child died, and he told me that one way I might be able to get through it is, and for instance, one of the techniques that he's told people about is keep a pad and paper, a pen and paper next to your bed. And when you go to bed at night, just write down a number for yourself on where your emotional temperature is that day, and only then will you be able to register that you're beginning to make a little bit of progress over time. It's those kinds of things. Donald Trump, to be perfectly blunt about it, wouldn't have the foggiest notion of how to help people get through it.
Okay, well, one other thing about him, just to stay with the two sons that you mentioned earlier on. I mean, he was close to Bo, and he died. He was an Iraqi war veteran. He died of a brain tumor 4 or 5 years ago. But his other son, Hunter, is it unfair to say, that's Joe Biden's greatest weakness?
Well, I think the truth is that the family has a long-running pattern of addiction. That is a fact. Joe Biden grew up sharing a bedroom at one point with an uncle who was, you know, had a terrible alcohol problem. And for that reason, Joe Biden never drank. He hasn't had a drop of alcohol. His son has had serious problems with drugs and alcohol throughout his life. And as is sometimes the case, that has ended up making mayhem of his professional life too. So he ended up taking a job as a board member, of course, of this gas company in Ukraine, which he then later apologized to his father for, because he said, I realized, you know, what a predicament that would put the family in. But I should point out here, Donald Trump was impeached because he was trying to get negative information from Ukraine that would show that Hunter Biden was giving his father some sort of, you know, favors back and forth to advance the business. And Ukraine didn't give it. There was none to give. And then two Republican-led committees in Congress went out in search of the same thing, and they couldn't find it. So at a certain point, we have to acknowledge that this has been an attempt by the Trump political operation to weaponize this fact, and it hasn't really worked.
Well then, Evan, do you have a sense of awe at just what this man has achieved and what he has finally become so late in life?
I have to tell you that I am, like a lot of political reporters, I have a bit of a thick skin, a bit of cynicism about most things that I encounter when it comes to politics. But when it comes to this man's story, his life, I mean, the sheer fact of his ability to carry on through painful things. I say this, you know, as a father, as a citizen, it's just quite remarkable. And I think it does serve this country particularly well at a moment when we are, let's be frank, we're basically flat on our back, hobbled by this virus, by the economy. And he comes to this with some acquaintance of suffering. And for that, I think we are all better off.
And that was Evan Osnos talking about U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, who will be inaugurated in a couple of weeks as the 46th President of the United States. Now, earlier I was talking about Denise Chyla having the Irish Song of the Summer. Well, the photo of the summer had to be Hollywood actor Matt Damon in his tracksuit with his shopping bag by the sea in Dalkey. Matt was spending his lockdown in Dalkey after production of the forthcoming Ridley Scott film The Last Duel was postponed. Here's Siobhan Berry now telling me about how that photo came about. Where was that, by the way, exactly in Dalkey?
It's Hawk Cliff. It's kind of like, yeah, you can just jump in off the rocks there into the water. So my husband and daughter would be big swimmers.
Yeah.
And like since about February, we would kind of go out after work or after school for a swim. And I decided to go that day. It was a beautiful sunny day. And we had heard that Matt Damon was in the area. So as I walked down, as he kind of... you have to come down a very long, steep step.
Yeah, I saw the other picture there. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, oh, it's absolutely, like, it looks like you're in Italy. It's beautiful. Yeah. So you walk down the steps, and I could see it was him. And I said to my husband, oh, my gosh, that's Matt Damon. So we had to pass him. But then, with the social distancing, we were, like, he was kind of leaning over, and we were leaning back. But I did an awkward hello as if I knew him, or as if he knew me. And then we just went off, and we kind of went off swimming, jumping off the rocks, and they went into the rock pool. So there was a big posse of them. There was himself, and then there was his kids, and it seemed like lots of minders and stuff. And they all kind of stuck together. And then as we were finished swimming, and as he was kind of coming up, we asked him for a photo, which he was very kind enough to let us take a photo. But what he still had the bag in his hand. So what it was that he had been out for a run and hadn't intended on going swimming. But when he got down there, he was sorry he didn't bring his swimsuit. But he was left holding all the togs and all the towels in the shopping bag. There was no cans in it. he stayed there and he talked to us about how he'd love to jump in. And we were saying it was pretty cold. And then... we were telling about how Ashley, my daughter, she's 11, how she does, you know, she does sea swims, and he was very impressed. So he was really polite. He was really lovely.
Siobhan Berry there, telling me about her family's encounter with Jason Bourne, a.k.a. Hollywood actor Matt Damon. I'll be right back with more interviews after these.
You're listening to the best of Dave Fanning on 2FM.